bringing you the truth behind the news. Welcome to The New American.
The Democrats concluded that Joe Biden and Alejandro Mayorkas, defying federal law, ignoring the text of the statute, deliberately releasing criminal illegal aliens over and over and over again, that's just hunky-dory. You can't impeach him for that. Every Democrat just voted. By the way, every cabinet member, guess what? You've just been given a blank slate. Ignore the law. When Democrats are in charge of the Senate, the entire cabinet could ignore the law. It is no longer impeachable. In Democrat wonderland, when a member of the executive branch openly defies the law.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Paul Dragoo. We're glad you joined us. That was Texas Senator Ted Cruz fuming about the Senate's refusal to hold the impeachment trial of Alejandro Mayorkas. Mayorkas is the secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, and he is in large part responsible for the most disastrous border policy, border crisis in American history. Now, this is the first time this has happened, and the man in charge, that Mayorkas, as we're going to see a little later, he may have been working on this and planning this for years before he held his current position. So we're going to talk about this sadly historic moment, and we're going to bring in Joe Wolverton, which is a New American's legal scholar, to tell us more about how unprecedented this is and whether or not this is constitutional. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Paul. How are you?
Well, I'm good, all things considering. I tend to answer that that question the same way every day. We're seeing some pretty sad and gloomy things. I feel like this thing that just happened here is another reminder that the left is intent on smashing any semblance that there has been and that there's left of the America that used to be. Tell us about the Senate's refusal to hold the impeachment trial of Mayorkas. Is it constitutional? We know that it's never happened, and we can discuss further about this thing.
Well, it's never happened, as you said. Is it strictly constitutional? I suppose one can debate the syntax of Article 1, Section 3, but there's something important to remember about that. If you interpret Article 1, Section 3 in such a way that would allow the Senate to refuse to try articles of impeachment sent to it by the House, then you would interpret the Constitution in a way that would lead to an absurdity. And one of the rules of interpretation of any contract, as any lawyer can tell you, is that you never interpret any clause in a contract in a way that would lead to an absurdity. It's like saying if someone in his will left a piece of land to one man and a well in the center of that piece of land to another man, you would never interpret that will to mean that since the land was given to one guy and the well to another, the man to whom the well was left could never access that well. That would be an absurdity. The law would interpret the will to grant access to the man who now owns the well to cross the yard to get to the well.
So he needs an easement.
An easement, yes, sir. That's the correct legal term. He would have an easement, a restricted easement, but an easement nonetheless. And in this case, when the Constitution clearly leaves impeachment to the House and the trying of those charges to the Senate, for the Senate to assume they don't have to try charges sent to him by the House is an absurdity, and it cannot be.
Yes. Well, what
otherwise,
do you mean?
There is no impeachment, right? There is no impeachment. This is once again Senate Democrats doing what they do and disregarding the Constitution in favor of their partisan interests, which many have already predicted will find its apogee in civil war. We have got to find a stop to this.
Well, who's saying that? Because I mean, I guess part of the Americans are getting tired to see something like this. That seems like another thing that is really going to inspire the fiery anger that Americans, normal, sane Americans, which I still think is a majority across the country, to exhibit. They're like, this is just ridiculous. You can see what's happening on the border. We had a picture of that, but you don't have to. I mean, you could go anywhere and see what's happening. Look, Ted Cruz says that they're blatantly ignoring the law. We're saying it's a little bit, but won't this come back and bite them in the behind? If let's say Trump gets back in the House, I want to get your thoughts on this. Trump gets back in the House, and we know that they're going to try to impeach him, or they've tried impeaching him before. What if this would have happened when they impeached Trump? You know, the articles of impeachment, the Senate decides to say the Republicans held the Senate or will hold the Senate, and they say, forget about it. This is what happened when they changed the confirmation right for judges, and McConnell used it, and then they brought in, I think it was two judges by that point, or at least one at the end there. Let me get your thoughts on that. Is this going to bite them back in the behind?
Well, I think there's no other way but that. I think it's going to have the effect that you will see. It will lead to more severe gridlock. It will lead to institutional dysfunction, as we've already seen Senator Mike Lee saying, if this is the way the Senate Democrats are going to behave, then he's promised to manipulate the Senate rules in his own way so as to completely end all the business of the Senate. And in the Senate, a single senator is endowed with extraordinary power compared to the House. And so, yes, you will see this. You will see, just as you've seen the lawfare used against Donald Trump by Democrats and those funded by Democrats, you are going to see that sort of thing, a cycle of that now. And ultimately, James Madison, remarkably, in the convention of 1787, predicted that this is the sort of thing that would happen. And you can read Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 65 predicted this very thing, that if you end up with senators preferring their party over principle, then you are going to have a never-ending cycle of political battles, political gridlock that will lead to, ultimately, James Madison said, to the destruction of the Republic.
Joe, tell us a little bit your thoughts on the two combating narratives here. Obviously, the Republicans are saying, look, he failed to uphold the law. He totally meets the standard to be impeached. They've said that. Now, on the other side, the left, whether they mean it or not, they're saying there's no sign of high crimes and misdemeanors. Did, in your opinion, should Mayorkas have been impeached or not? Did he meet the standard?
Absolutely met the standard. There's actually an article that I wrote, a very lengthy article about this in the New American some years ago. And yes, he absolutely met the standard. And if he didn't, if the Senate absolutely believed that these charges were so spurious and failed to cross the requisite constitutional threshold of high crimes and misdemeanors, then hold a trial and demonstrate that.
Yeah,
because by doing that, they would not only uphold the oath that they were already sworn in when they performed this little trick. So they would not only uphold the oath, but they would demonstrate to the House, hey, you guys have got to, you know, increase the standards that you're using for impeachment. And it would be a sign to the American public that, hey, regardless of the fact that we're controlled by a certain party, we're going to be impartial. We're going to be true to the Constitution and demonstrate that this guy is not worthy of being removed from office. And that would be such a message to so many people, to the House, to the American people, right? And it might even have the effect of restoring the reputation of Mayorkas. I doubt that. But at least if something is so ridiculous so as to not reach the requisite level of high crimes and misdemeanors, prove it. Hold the trial and let's see the trial come down to an absolute landslide in favor of Mayorkas, thus demonstrating to everybody, A, that the system works, and B, that that senators can rise above partisan loyalty.
Well, that's certainly not what they're doing. We were talking, me, Gary, and Steve, and Gary and Steve are going to join us shortly in the next few seconds. And I mean, it seems like it's pretty obvious why they're doing this. They don't want any more publicity on what's happening on this disastrous border. I can't imagine any other reason that why they would not do this. Do you think it's going to hurt Democrats in the elections?
Well, I mean, right now, I checked this morning, and congressional approval rating is at an all-time low of 12%. So I think it definitely will affect, because I do, like you, I believe most Americans are well-intentioned and want a peaceful, prosperous country. And I think they will, I'm hopeful they will recognize that by the Senate, this action by the Senate does nothing but show complete disdain and disregard for Constitution, and that it isn't just a partisan infighting like refusing to nominate someone. This is historical. This is unique. And this is a true foundational, shock to the institution and to the Constitution.
Thank you, Joe Overton. All right, folks, after this, we're going to look at what appears to be some sort of well-organized scheme to bring illegals into this country to vote for Joe Biden.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Is the American left mounting a major election fraud operation with illegal aliens? Muckraker discovered flyers posted at illegal alien transport centers in Mexico, and the flyers are encouraging illegals on their way to the southern border and on their way to the U.S. to vote in the 2024 election, and you won't be surprised to find out they're encouraging them to vote for Biden. Now, by the way, urging illegals to vote is a federal crime. The flyers were found throughout the Resource Center Matamoros in Tamaulipas, Mexico, and apparently they were found in porta potties, among other places, perhaps. Now, this resource center is also the home of HIAS, H-I-A-S, and it used to be an acronym that stood for the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. Now, I guess it's just HIAS. Either way, it is a subversive organization that moves illegals into the U.S. And check this out. HIAS has received money from globalist and funder of anti-American DAs and a former Nazi collaborator, and that's George Soros. Now, there's more. At one point, guess who was a board member of HIAS? And that was Alejandro Mayorkas, the DHS secretary we mentioned last segment there. So we have another connected dot here. Now, former Border Patrol agent and author of the book Invaded, J.J. Carroll, was recently on OANN. And here's what he said about how long this invasion has been in planning and what role Alejandro Mayorkas has been playing in it.
When you look at Mayorkas, he is the tip of the spear. Mm-hmm. Mayorkas was the director of USCIS, which is a powerful position. If you go back, he is the creator and facilitator of every immigration policy that we are witnessing today. He created DACA. He created a catch and release. He created the asylum mess. He also bastardized the parole system and totally abused every immigration policy and law. So when you go back to Obama's years and you see Mayorkas make it from the USCIS to the deputy secretary of DHS and now the secretary of DHS, he has had his hand in the destruction of the American immigration system all the way back to 2008. But this is strategic and it is intentional by our government to fundamentally transform the United States of America through destroying the immigration process. And it's no longer a debate. This is exactly what's happening. And anyone that has half or two brain cells banging against each other, we know that this is the truth.
All right, so joining me for the rest of today's stories is Editor-in-Chief of the New American Magazine, Gary Benoit, and we have Executive Senior Editor Steve Bonta. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Yep.
So, Steve, the more layers we peel off this onion, the more evidence comes out that this is a well-funded, well-organized effort to subvert laws and the will of the people. But you know what's crazy, and we mentioned last last segment too, is we can't get any semblance of punishment and an accountability in any of this. It's absolutely insane, isn't it?
Well, and particularly, I mean, Mayorkas, as we've been saying, he's a key guy.
Yeah.
He's a key guy, and that's why he's untouchable. That's why they're willing to, I mean, I think what happened yesterday,
with the Senate,
just to put my own two cents in regarding the whole, the refusal to impeach, that is at least as consequential as Congress effectively setting aside its constitutionally mandated duty to declare war back more than, you know, a half century ago, 70, 80 years ago, when we decided, okay, we'll let the UN do that for us for now on. This is a constitutional putsch of comparable magnitude. And it's being done now under these circumstances because Mayorkas is so valuable to the radical left deep state subversives who are hell-bent on destroying our country.
Yeah.
We're seeing the destruction accelerate so alarmingly, and a large part of it is because of the chaos being unleashed by these wave after wave after wave, millions upon millions of illegals who are pouring into this country.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're coming to this country primarily from places, you know, a lot of, I hate to mischaracterize them and sound like a racist, okay, but these aren't highly educated professionals pouring in, eager to share their talents with the United States and create capital. These are people, you know, frankly, a lot of them are coming from incredibly poor, backward countries, are supportive, frankly, ignorant of the things we talk about on our show.
You know,
they're going to be supportive of socialist policies. They're going to bring them here.
Right.
And now we find out, well, they're being encouraged in Matamoros, Mexico, as they're getting ready to, you know, come across the border. They're being encouraged by American subversives to, when you get there, don't forget to vote for Biden.
Yeah.
You know, by any means possible. This is, it's not surprising, but it's just outrage heaped upon outrage. And it's being done for the transparent purpose of destroying the American body politic. Because, of course, that is what the deep state conspiracy and the radical left, or do I repeat myself, intend to do. They despise our country. They despise our Constitution. Sometimes their despite is not well concealed.
Okay? Yeah.
Most of the time they pretend like they like it, but their goal is to get
not
rid of
anymore.
It, all that racist patriarchy, oppression, all the other stuff, and replace it with their enlightened vision of
Gary,
how things should be.
You said not anymore, but I think it depends on who the audience is.
Yeah.
If the audience is the American people, what are the American people told? They are told that there was no election steal in 2020, right?
Right.
They are told that that election was the safest election, the most secure election in the history of the Republic,
or
actually, to use their terminology, the history of the democracy.
Yeah.
So that's what we are told. But then the people coming over the border, were they told, well, while you're in the United States illegally, do not forget to vote and make sure you vote for Biden. There's an obvious contradiction there. exactly.
Well,
and so it is just so blatant. But in a way, it's good it's so blatant because people do see it. People are waking up.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the people waking up, including obviously people who are watching or listening to this show, need to get involved to effect change, because if that does not happen, we are going to be overwhelmed and we will lose our freedoms.
Well, Gary, you've I mentioned this often and for good reason. You have been the editor-in-chief for a long time, for decades. And so we've been warning. The magazine has been warning. I'd say it's the best. I'd say it's been the longest and best most consistent source in saying this is what's coming. But it's never been this blatant, has it? I mean, we did 1980.
It's so in your face, but I'm glad you mentioned about the track record.
Not this blatant nor this rapid.
Right.
Yeah.
Because going back to 1986, for example, one of our writers, Kurt Hyde, who actually is a board member of the John Birch Society, but he wrote an article for the New American back in 1986 warning about the dangers of voting machines and the necessity of having a paper trail.
Right.
So our warnings go back a number of decades.
Well,
and, of course, over the years, Kurt has continued to write articles for the New American about the dangers of the voting machines and the necessity of having paper ballots, or at least a paper trail.
Well, we also did a documentary, correct me if I'm wrong, it was 89 or 88, about the invasion. We had long-time senior editor Bill Jasper, William F. Jasper. He went on the border, and we made this terrific documentary. Unfortunately, it's sad, but it's right. Well done. And so we were warning about this then, and now it's just, like you said, it's so much more blatant, and it's rapid. There's another thing that's happening that's super, super concerning and related to this, and that is that American teens, I don't know if you guys heard this, but apparently American teens are getting involved in smuggling humans. It's absolutely crazy. So the cartels are sucking in teens, and there is even kind of related is there is even a Texas National Guardsman who was found smuggling humans. And so it's like, this is how crazy it is. Now the cartels are picking off National Guardsmen of the U.S. military, and they're picking off teens here. They're paying them, I guess, big money to do this. This is what has happened in this country. It's absolutely crazy, isn't it, Steve?
Well, you know, the old expression, if you sow the wind often enough, sooner or later you're going to reap the whirlwind. And that's what we have now. We've been allowing these people to sow the wind for decade after decade, assuming that there's always going to be maybe a slow drip of radicalism and fascism or whatever, however you choose to style it. But it's never going to turn into something absolutely catastrophic that threatens to, you know, bids fair to just wipe us off. And now we're in the early stages, mind you, of
the
an
last
absolute
stage?
Political demographic catastrophe that could end up wiping this country as we know it off the map if we don't act soon.
Thank you, guys. So after this, in Brussels, police shut down an event with populist leaders. We're going to look at that.
Imprisonment, forced labor, permanent separation from my family, perhaps death. I knew what could happen to people who were caught trying to defect. But the watchtowers stood yards away. The possibility of a new life in a different world, one without tyranny, was within sight. The West. I thought of the rewards no longer crushed under the boot of communism. I would work and make money, no longer restrained by the chains of collectivism. I would say what I wanted, without fear of spies and informants nearby. I would be free. The frozen rain and Romanian mud seeped my gloves and cloths. I fantasized about a fire burning in the wood stove of my parents' home, but I pushed those thoughts from my mind, closed my eyes, and waited for the cover of the darkness.
Get Defector, a true story of tyranny, liberty, and purpose by Mark Hobovkovich with Paul Dragoo, a thrilling page-turner that will remind you how precious yet vulnerable freedom is. Available at shopjbs.org or Amazon. For a limited time, get 20% off your entire order using promo code DEFECTOR20 when you purchase Defector at shopjbs.org.
All right, welcome back, folks. So, like I said last segment, in Brussels, Belgian police shut down an event with populist leaders Nigel Farage and the president of Hungary, Viktor Orban. Check this out.
The moment the police are saying that the event is creating public disturbance and therefore it will be closed down gradually, the way that's going to work is you can all stay here as long as you want for the time being, but if you walk out of the building, they're not going to let you back in. If by some chance there's a decision to apply greater force to shutting us down, then I can assure you that we will continue tomorrow morning at a different venue.
Steve, you found this story. This is this was pretty disturbing, and it seems like tyranny is alive and well everywhere, but there's more developments on this. So fill us in on the story.
Well, it has a semi-happy ending. This unfolded in a large neighborhood of Brussels, Belgium, okay, which is really the belly of the beast as far as the European Union is concerned.
The capital of the EU.
Sure, it's the capital of the EU, and there are a lot of, you know, prominent UN-connected offices there as well. So Brussels is a pretty big deal. Apparently, Brussels does not have a single mayor of the entire city, but every district has its own mayor. And the mayor of this particular district, Emir Gir or something like that is his name, is a Turk and a Muslim. And it turns out he's a denier of the Armenian genocide, among many other things. And he went on record saying, well, you know, These far-right extremists are not welcome in our city, and that's why I did this, in effect. But so that's the beginning of the story. That's what we saw. But it generated a surprising amount of outrage, even in Belgium.
Yeah.
It ended up going to a Belgian high court, and equivalent to like a U.S. circuit court or something like that, and they overturned it. And the meeting, the conference resumed the following day, and people were outraged. In fact, I have to say, for once, you know, the European lefties said, hey, we may disagree with these people. They're scary nationalists and populists and possibly even fascists. Who knows? But, you know, this is not what Europe is supposedly about. And Belgium's case particularly, the Belgian president came out and said this is an embarrassment.
Yeah.
The Belgian constitution since the 1830s has guaranteed freedom of speech. I personally don't like these people necessarily. Obviously, they know that Nigel Farage is like the bête noire of the entire European Union. He's the Brexit guy.
Yeah.
And everyone knows who Viktor Orban is as well and so forth. So,
and there were other populist leaders.
But kudos to them for getting it right after a fashion. Of course, the other aspect of the story is to say, okay, why is this such a big deal? This happens routinely at American university campuses. Mm. We call it cancellation. And a number of events, because this is how what the left does is this. They go to an event that involves people they don't like. They stir up trouble, even to the point of creating barricades, throwing firebombs, creating a riot, attacking people. And then they say, look, there's violence and problems. You need to set the, you know, for public safety, you know, you need to shut the event down. This has been their modus operandi since the French Revolution, for crying out loud, is they stir up trouble. And then they say, you need to have government come and take care of the trouble. Yeah. So that's what they did here. That's what they do in the likes of Berkeley and so forth in the United States. I don't see it going away anytime soon, but frankly, this is a positive story. Mm. I think the takeaway is that there are still reasonable people, even among those who are ideologically opposed to us,
yeah,
who are at least fair enough to say, as many leftists once did, you know, I may disagree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it.
Yeah.
Would that there would be more such.
I know in the case of Brussels, the particular mayor for that district actually went to the hotel and said, do you know who these people really are? And got the hotel to break the contract.
Well, there were a couple. They had two different venues, mm-hmm, apparently, that they had all set up. And this was like the third venue, mm-hmm, that they finally got. And so in this case, I guess that they were willing to break the contract. So he sent in the gendarme instead. And mm-hmm, we saw the result.
I like what you said about, I want to kind of go into that the left, these old school lefties, the old school Democrats. And I know we still have some of them here. I used to work with them. Now I don't work with any lefties, but up until I started working here, this, especially in the newspaper business, most of them were lefties. They were Democrats. They were union people, things like that. But we always held to this mantra, like you say, it's like, I may disagree with you, but I will defend to the death your right to speak. And I think there's more of that. And I'm almost wondering if what's happening now, this censorship, this attack on people they don't agree with, is inspiring more Democrats, more left of center people to stand up and say, well, this is going overboard.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing that with the Yuri Berliner story, which we're going to cover also,
next,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, we've covered it already. We have more to say about that. You know, I don't know, Alan Dershowitz comes to mind as being probably
Bill Maher in a way.
Yeah, in varying degrees, you know, yeah. you do have this.
And maybe Elon Musk.
Perhaps. I mean,
it's hard to tell where
in
Elon
some
Musk
cases
is now,
you have
yeah.
people like Tulsi Gabbard who kind of start out as leftist-ish
yeah.
and then realize, okay, these really aren't my people. And they end up migrating to the so-called right because they say, well, that's actually who the tolerant people are
yeah.
at this point. So,
but
yeah.
Something really important to keep in mind, though, is not every Democrat is, somebody who's anti-God and anti-man. I mean, obviously, most of them are not. The party's control from the top, but you have a lot of Democrats who are sincere. They are honest Democrats.
Yeah.
And they see what's happening and they say, oh my goodness, I'm a member of that party. I support that. Of course I don't. And so Democrats are waking up as well as Republicans.
Yeah. Well, this is what it takes. And I'm hoping, because we need them. We need people, everyone, to realize what is happening. And I think it's coming around to that. Let's go to that Yuri Berliner story. Am I saying his name right? Berliner?
Yeah, Yuri Berliner.
Now, he was I didn't even know he was still part of NPR when he wrote that initial, I guess it was some sort of op-ed.
He was, but not for long.
Yeah. So fill us in on the backstory, and then we're going to continue. We're going to continue on this conversation.
Well, the backstory is very simple. I mean, Yuri Berliner wrote an op-ed piece, which we reviewed, I guess, talked about in the show a few days back,
yeah,
in which he said, you know, this isn't your grandfather's NPR. It's not the same organization. But it was actually, I mean, you know, it was critical, but not in a vicious, underhanded way. He bent over backwards to say, I love the place, very, you know, great collegial environment. But yeah, every, you know, 87 people that work here, all 87 are Democrats. And I think that's a problem. And increasingly, since 2016, our coverage has gotten away from, you know, the warm, fuzzy interviews with, let's say, a farmer in Iowa or something like that, and more and more and more into things that are just ultra woke,
yeah,
that only resonate with a very small woke audience.
It became strictly regime propaganda.
Right. And he went on to point out that, you know, that I tried to point this out in multiple meetings and was kind of met with polite silence. Well, he finally wrote about it. And let's just say it was met with more than polite silence. The first thing they did was they suspended him without pay for 5 days. Well, that's the only thing they did. And he realized at that point that he was clearly he had violated the code of omerta. And so he was no longer welcome and he resigned. So he's no longer with NPR. I suspect, you know, being basically an honest lefty, like in the vein of like Matt Taibbi or somebody like that.
Schellenberger.
People like this. He's not going to have trouble finding work. He's a good journalist.
Yeah.
And he's, I think, a decent, you know, intellectually honest guy, even if, you know, from our point of view, he's wrongheaded on a lot of issues. But on the other hand, you have to consider he was raised, he's basically a red diaper baby. He mentioned that in his, you know, he was raised in this ultra radical environment. So it's hardly surprising he turned out that way. But, I think the problem, you know, what stories like this point out is the fact that the left increasingly, at least the dominant, the so-called radical left, which is really dominant now,
yeah,
on the left, you know, even among Democrats, doesn't believe in fair play. They are street fighters. We saw this, and this is of a piece with the impeachment story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're willing to do whatever they have to do to enact their agenda. But there are a lot of people, even people who disagree with us, who still have a sense of basic morality, decency, and fair play, who are, I think and I hope, are abandoning them. The problem is the tribal instinct is so strong that a lot of people who maybe once thought that way are being drawn more and more into this extremist left narrative that anyone who disagrees with us, and MAGA Republicans and their ilk in particular, are not just wrongheaded, they're evil.
Yeah.
And anything we can do to stamp them out and otherwise suppress them and cancel them is completely justified, even if it means jettisoning the entire constitutional system.
Yeah, well, I mean, college campuses, they would have like they'd be chanting stupid things like, what is it, like silence is or speech is violence and things like that. And that was part of how they were raising up these new generations of progressives to justify quashing beliefs and thoughts and ideas and views that they totally disagree with. We're going to continue this conversation because we want to talk about the media propaganda landscape as a whole.
The John Birch Society has been working tirelessly since 1958 to preserve freedom, safeguard the Constitution, and restore our God-given rights. We continually educate voters and lead the freedom movement. Join us as we work against a tyrannical one-world government. United as one, we can defeat this conspiracy against a free America. JBS founder Robert Welch said, "Education is our total strategy and truth our only weapon." Go to jbs.org and join us in restoring this great nation.
All right, we're back. So as we were running this story, it reminded me of another story that we ran this week. And that was during that hearing, the judiciary hearing, that included former CBS journalist Cheryl Atkinson and Ms. Herridge, Catherine Herridge, who was held in contempt. CBS fired her. They took her files because they're trying to find out who in the heck is her source and things like that. And it just makes you wonder, are the journalists, because we need the journalists to wake up. And it seems like between Berliner coming out and of course, Herridge and Atkinson has been out for a long time. I read her book, Slanted, I believe is the one. She's had two. There's one called Smeared, one Slanted. And she documents very well how they kill stories that they don't like from the very top. And this is how conspiratorial forces work. I mean, we know from the Venona files, for instance, that the communists had infiltrated every government agency. I believe that's what the Venona files showed. And that's what the historians who looked at it said. And so what happens is when they take over, when institutions are captured, and this is what's hard for people, I think, who don't believe in any conspiracies to understand, is because it is complicated, right? It's like not everyone, you know, because they're like, what are you saying? Like, you know, someone gets their little orders every morning, every journalist, every government. No, what happens is they capture the main positions. And what Cheryl Atkinson shows in her book is, for instance, she mentioned Solyndra. And again, we mentioned this earlier. So Solyndra was this green boondoggle that Obama oversaw. So she gets a call from the unions, and the unions are saying, hey, this isn't even, this money is barely any of this is going to American workers. So she meets with the union leader. She, you know, they put the story together, her and her colleagues. They start shipping it, and an executive in New York kills the story. That is how they control the media. Go ahead, Gary. I see you wanting to jump.
Well, I agree completely with everything you said.
There's that, no one controlling it from here.
But you know, just to extend your remarks, I do think there are some strings going down to some people, obviously. But for the most part, that's not the case. For the most part, people are beguiled into doing the work of the conspiracy. They're useful idiots.
Yeah.
And I like you to make a distinction, too, between the story we're talking about with PBS and the New American Magazine, because I'm sure some listeners or viewers would say, well, gee, doesn't the New American have a point of view? And, of course, we do. And
Do we
present that point of view?
Yeah.
And, of course, we do. I mean, we believe we're on the right side, and so we're going to prevent the right side. And we believe we're old enough to know the difference between right and wrong, right? But a huge difference between PBS or
NPR
NPR and PBS, the New York Times and whatnot, the major media in us, is that they're being dishonest. They claim they're being objective, and they are not being objective.
Well, they're
they're claiming they're presenting all the news that's fit
the
print,
yeah.
But they're really only presenting all the news that fits, right? Whereas the New American, we are honest. We do have a point of view, and we're honest about that as well, but we don't try to skew the facts. We do everything we can to be as honest as we can and not take anything out of context, whereas the major media is skewing everything.
Yeah.
They are propagandists trying to present a narrative that, if followed, would lead to the destruction of our freedoms.
Well, Gary, but...
And we should just point out, there are many occasions when we find a story that looks very provocative, some online news source, something like that, and we wonder, oh, should we cover that in the magazine or on the show or something like that? And we look into it a while, and sometimes we do, and sometimes we say, you know, we really don't think there's enough evidence here to support this. Mm-hmm. It may be true, but we don't see a basis for that.
Well, so we do try to be Francis Scott Key Bridge, we haven't really said a whole lot about that because there isn't.
Yeah, because we don't know.
There's not a whole lot there. I want to go back to your comments about as far as our magazine being biased versus newspapers. There is a difference between newspapers and magazines. Magazines are expected to be biased, to have their own opinions and to show that, whereas newspapers are supposed to be objective. And supposedly there was this golden era. I don't know where this golden era is, maybe from the 1920s to like maybe the 60s or whatever, where supposedly they were objective. But like you said, what was really happening is it was stealth. It was not objective. It was still advocacy. I mean, we talked about a project where I brought up Mockingbird. Steve, jump in over here. Mockingbird was a CIA operation, and we know there's documents, there's declassified documents showing that the CIA has friendly reporters. We know from Harwood, which was the editor-in-chief or editor-at-large of the Washington Post in 1992, he wrote that op-ed called Ruling Class Journalists.
Yes.
And he talks about how journalists don't merely report, and this was specific to foreign policy, but they make policy.
Well,
that's what...
You know, I just want to get back to something that we talked about briefly. I know, but I want to talk about Walter Lippmann for just another couple minutes.
Because, another guy you mentioned this week. Yeah.
Well, because this happened about 100 years ago, and Lippmann really was the guy who came up with, who dreamed up the model for what we live in now. Prior to World War I, yes, there was an American elite establishment, but it was nowhere near as powerful because the federal government largely was kept within its constitutional limitations. There were no, you know, so I don't want to get into detail there, but suffice it to say, at the end of the war, Lippmann wrote this book, and of course, this is in the time of the Wilson administration, the first truly modern leftist, utopian leftist, ultra-liberal administration that we've had. Okay, very similar to what we have right now. Okay, so he wrote a book called Public Opinion, and in this, Lippmann, who was a journalist, an elite journalist at that, said, you know, henceforth, it is no longer going to be the purpose of the news media tried to hew to this absurd ideal of only reporting the facts, because he said, you know, there's just too much stuff out there. You can't report it all. To start with, editors have to make judicious decisions on what is and is not news.
Yes.
Which is undoubtedly true.
Well, no, that makes sense.
At some point,
we do that
too. So human bias, you know, and discretion does unavoidably enter into the news.
Absolutely.
The news making or the news reporting process. Okay. But he went on to say, from now on, the federal government is going to play a much different role in the country. It's going to be involved in everything. Agriculture, you know, farm price supports, all this. He very much saw the New Deal and what, you know, a little more than a decade later, what was coming. He said, you know, we've grown to the point where we realize that this old antiquated model of this limited, weak federal government is not going to work. We're going to have a much larger federal government. And so the result is that it's going to be the job of the news media to work with the government and his memorable phrase, which has been popularized by Noam Chomsky and others, was to manufacture consent. And so they're not just going to be in the business henceforth of selecting what is and is not newsworthy, but what does and does not dovetail with the interests of this new you know, government and financial establishment, whose job it is going to be henceforth, you know, to control business, to control the farms, to basically be what we, the government that we know now, which is involved in virtually everything we do. He foresaw all of this.
Well, it's the
because he was one of the people that one of the people that created it. One of the ideologues who thunk it up in the first place.
Yeah. Okay? So the media is the PR arm of the regime.
So we have the media establishment today is basically the brainchild of Walter Lippmann and other like-minded, you know, far-sighted in the negative sense of the term, far-sighted establishmentarian journalist types of 100 years ago. Some of these people were also the founders of the Council on Foreign Relations
at about the
same time. That also happened right after, you know, Lippmann was one of the guys on the group of experts that dreamed up all of the Treaty of Versailles stuff, including the League of Nations. He was part of all that. So all of this stuff is linked together, and it was created by design with the idea that henceforth we should have this monolithic government in lockstep with a monolithic information industry. Another thing that Lippmann pointed out, which was evident even in the 20s, was that media was not going to be print for much longer. The new power of radio and visual media, which were exploited to some extent during World War I for the propagandists, was going to enable government to just have a much, much greater role. And that's what we're seeing.
Not to put too fine a point on it, in a free country, the media should be the watchdog of government.
Yeah.
Yep.
The media, instead, under the Lippmann agenda, has become the lapdog by the government.
Well, and apparently Berliner and Atkinson and Harris didn't get the memo, and we have a few seconds left, but this is probably a perfect time to plug the New American. If you're listening and you're watching and you do want a source that is biased but in favor of pro-American views and constitutionally adherent views, subscribe to the New American. Go to thenewamerican.com. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of The New American Daily. Remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And we'll see you tomorrow when we'll be talking about money.